So welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner here on the Mark Steiner Show at our Annapolis Summit with our partners, of course, the Daily Record, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, being heard around the state. And in the second part of our Annapolis Summit, we always have a conversation with, as some like to call it, the two mics, or as Mike Bush likes to put it, the three M's. Here on the stage, our Speaker of the House, Michael Bush, our President of the Senate, Mike Miller, and all of you. Microphone is there. If you have questions, please go there and stand up by the mic so you can be heard and have your voices heard. Gentlemen, welcome. Good to have you with us once again for the 13th Annapolis Summit.
Good to be here.
13 years.
13 years.
So, other than looking in the mirror this morning and seeing I have more gray hair than I did last year. I'm trying to catch up with the two of you. Let's begin with these kind of questions. The first thing I asked the governor was that it appeared there was a line being drawn in the sand in terms of this question of mandates and what mandates are to the state, the requirement of what the state has to spend. 87% of the dollar, as he put it, is spent on these mandates. So you both have comments about that. So, and you, one of the things you said, I think, President Miller, was that you're not going to see cuts in education, but you would be willing to consider some question of cutting in mandates. What were you talking about?
Well, mandates really are not good government, honestly and truly. And it's only when the views of the elected officials, the legislative body elected by all the people, are totally neglected do you have to resort to a mandate. Last year, the government cut $68 million in public education. I'm the oldest of 10 children. I've got 5 children and 14 grandchildren. We are what we are today, as is most of us, because of educational opportunities. And because the governor did that, we want to make certain this governor, during his next 3 years or next 7 years, however long he's here, doesn't have that same opportunity to cut public education again. So we passed a mandate mandating that that not be cut. Now, we'll look at certainly other mandates, but the governor's also said that legislature is not to do its constitutional duty in terms of cutting the budget and fencing off money for other programs. He said, guess what? I will not fund it. It's going to drop to the bottom. So in other words, he hasn't communicated to us in terms of any of these proposals we've read about in the newspaper so far. And we put something forth that he's just going to cut it and it's going to go to the bottom. Then our only resource then is to pass a law saying, Governor, you've got to fund this proposal. We're going to pass a mandate.
Speaker Bush?
With education, obviously, there's two constitutional mandates. One is a balanced budget, and the other is to fund an adequate and equitable education for every child. and the reason we had the Thornton Commission is because the state was sued, if you remember, for not adequately funding Baltimore City schools and other counties. And the commission got together and said this is what the funding sources would be. We had to come back when they put a stay, the judge put a stay on that order until we would come up with a methodology to fully fund K-12 education. The geographic index cost was not considered to be part of that mandate, but it had been implemented for 3 years before Governor Hogan had taken office, and the expectations from the counties were that they were going to get that in their education funding. So last year...
And they budgeted for it.
So last year, we found ways in the budget to deal with it. But last year we passed a law that says basically the geographic index cost is part of that mandate. So, I mean, counties can have the stability to know that they're going to get the full funding. I mean, look, increased enrollment means you have to increase funding for education.
You have no choice.
I mean, it's not like you can cap it like you're a private school or something, say we're only going to take 700 kids. Every child goes to public school. So when the enrollment goes up, you have to be able to accommodate that as well in your budget. And that's why you have a 2% increase every year as a cost of living that goes into your education funding as well. But that's something that the state has prided itself on, and one of the reasons we're number one in the country in education is because we've adequately funded every subdivision, regardless whether they're poor or whether they're wealthy, basically the same rate for every child.
So there are two things here. I'm going to explore it a little deeper. A is this argument over what fully funded education means. Did it happen in the last 13 years? Did it not happen in the last 13 years? Did we spend more last year than we have in other years? What's the reality?
Let me just say this. we implemented gradually the full funding authority. That was a $2 billion increase. It did not take place all in 1 year, but it took place during the tougher economic times, and we made it work. So that was a debate from the Ehrlich administration to the O'Malley administration to where we finally fully funded K-12 education. And every year it's going to go up. Every governor is going to make a greater contribution to education than the year before because enrollment goes up. That's a simple fact of life. So we fully fund education. Yes, we do. The things, the expectations from the citizens of the state of Maryland expect us to do. The other mandates basically are federal. I mean, you have to deal with Medicaid. You were a 50-50 match state. So if somebody qualifies to be on the rolls for Medicaid, you have to match it to get your federal money. There is no option there.
So when you say mandates are bad government, what does that mean? I mean, so you know that down the road there are going to be huge battles over money. One of the things that the governor talks about is cutting back waste in government, which he said he did. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that and what that means. But in the outlying years, there are going to be battles over revenue versus our expenditures, right? So right. If you don't have mandates
are bad is that elected officials and their designee are supposed to be wise enough so they can pick and choose what's best. For the people of the state of Maryland. And sometimes there's going to be revenue shortfalls, sometimes there's going to be revenue increases. They should have that ability to make that discretion or this decision. But when there's abuse of that discretion, then mandates come into play. And also in terms of public education, reason we're number one in education for the state and the United States is we do things that other states don't do. Whether you like it or not, we provide aid to parochial education. Whether you like it or not, we build public schools. Only five states in the United States do that. And you say, how much do we do for education? Some years we put in $250 for school construction. Some years we put in $350 million for school construction. It's a discretionary area in that area. But we're building public schools. These fine public schools, these buildings, these capital plants, you're seeing because the legislature provides that. Just north of us, Pennsylvania right now, they don't have a budget. Because they can't agree between the Democratic governor and the Republican General Assembly in terms of finding money to fund poorer areas of the state. Our Eastern Shore and our Western Maryland subdivisions, even though they might not be as wealthy as some of our urban subdivisions, getting the same amount dollar per child as across the state.
So where do you see the fault lines happening this year then? I mean, one of the things that... Go ahead, what are you going to say, Speaker? I thought you were about to say something.
Where do I see the fault lines?
Yeah.
First of all, I mean, and I'll go back to the President of the Senate statement, is we read everything in the newspaper like everyone else. I mean, it's not like they've shared the ideas of what their tax relief is going to be or what these mandate reliefs are. So I have no idea what mandates they're talking about removing. So until you see the specifics of what mandates they want to remove from the operating budget, it's tough to make a comment on them. So it's tough to make a comment on things that you read about in the newspapers, like the $700 million to Baltimore. Most of that's all money that's going to Baltimore anyway. We don't know that there's any new money in there. Department of Legislative Services did an analysis on that. And it looks like there's no new money going into the city of Baltimore. But you have $700 million that's announced in the press without any information really given to the House or the Senate on where that money is actually being appropriated for.
We're told that there's only $17 million new money a year for four monies, other than monies already committed. But it looks like $700 million to Baltimore. We don't know that. Government is a team effort. I don't want to sound like some crybaby or sour grapes or something like that. But in terms of government, you need to be able to share ideas. And these proposals, I understand they're old Democratic ideas, rehashed ones that have been rejected before. It'd be good if you just talk to us and we'd say, Governor, this is the reason we didn't pass them before when Rich Malino proposed these bills. Why, this is something that Marvin Holmes from Prince George's County put forth and we didn't do it. Let me tell you why. If we'd had this conversation, maybe we could lead them in the right direction. But as the Speaker says, the problem is communication. It's the same problem between husbands and wives. You want to stay married, you got to be able to communicate. You know, you got to. I came home the other night. My wife comes. You went and started eating dinner before you talked to me? Are you crazy? This is after 50 years of marriage, you know? I mean, you have to be able to communicate and make things happen in your marriage as well as government.
So.
That'll
be your new post-senatorial career.
Stay married.
The veto overrides, are they happening?
Let me just make one comment here. First of all, there's about 100 vetoes. We'll sustain about 94 of them. There's six that the vast majority of members supported that the governor vetoed.
Those are the ones I'm talking about.
Yeah, so we'll special order those on opening day today and take them up next week. And some of them are somewhat controversial, but many people feel very strongly about them. So we'll give strong consideration to overriding six vetoes, yes.
Do you think that the one that people have talked about at least a lot in Baltimore and around has been the question of the felon's right to vote while on parole and probation? Are the numbers there?
Well, look, I think that, you know, when we meet in caucus, we'll discuss that. But we got 84 votes for that last year in the House. I think we'll pick up an 85th vote. You need two-thirds to do that. But the fact of the matter is these people are on parole, and the evidence and the data shows that those individuals that come out and can participate in the process while they're on parole, as they're going through the process of working their way back into the workplace, and hopefully becoming productive citizens, that it's helped keep them from reoccurrence in crime and reincarceration.
Well, it's part of a major package that the governor and the General Assembly are going to agree upon, because we've set up this commission that worked in South Carolina, worked in Texas, and worked elsewhere, of taking money out of certain areas of corrections and reinvesting it, saving money by putting small-time offenders, particularly drug offenders, incarcerating, and instead of putting them in beds, putting them in treatment, saving that money and using them to hire probation agents to monitor, to avoid recidivism, what have you. Our goal is to bring these people back to society, get them drug-free, have them monitored, get them a job, and let them feel that they're really part of society again. And that means being a bona fide citizen that can exercise their right to go to the polls.
Let me start by opening up here. Brian Sears, are you in the audience? Are you going to make the first question throw up? As usual, our partner of the Daily Record, while he makes his way up here. And then we'll go to the rest of the audience for the President and Speaker.
Good morning, Mr. Speaker. Good morning, Mr. President.
Good morning, Brian.
Wanted to follow up a little bit on the issue of mandates, because this is clearly going to be a discussion we're going to have during the next 90 days. And wanted to get a sense of where maybe the common ground is with Democrats. There have been times when the legislature has altered mandated spending, and wanted to get a sense of whether or not there is any sort of common ground to be had on the idea of limiting mandated spending at times when revenue growth doesn't sort of match the projected spending.
That sounds like a worthy idea, Brian, but it sounds like a worthy item of discussion between the governor, the speaker, myself, and the legislative leaders, Democrats and Republicans, and we're happy to meet with those persons and discuss it. Many of the ideas that we govern ourselves by came from Democrats, Republican legislators sitting down, the spending affordability limit. You know, the last time I voted for a tax cut was during the Glendening administration, a major tax cut across the board. That was Democrats and Republican legislators insisting upon it, not Governor Glendening. Same thing was true with Governor Schaefer. Democrats and Republican legislators came up with a tax cut in the Schaefer administration. But it's sitting down and making things happen. It's communicating. It's government working together. And again, this governor is new to government. He didn't serve in the county council or county executive or House of Delegates or state senator. The public, I think, probably think that's good, but it's bad in terms of the institution and that he doesn't know what he's done before or how to avoid the pitfalls that have occurred previously. So we're going to be happy. The speaker, myself, are going to continue to extend open arms to this administration to work with us, explain what they want to do and we'll see if we can find out how to make it positive things happen.
Let me just give you an example here. You know, our constitutional mandate is fully fund the K-12 education system. We don't have a constitutional mandate to fund transportation or open space or anything like that. So when we run into tough economic times, we had transferred money from the Transportation Trust Fund to cover the cost of education, or we transferred money from Program Open Space to cover the cost of education. So we shifted those monies around in tough economic times because they are not mandates. They are directed funds, but they are not mandates. Well, the issue of directing funds from transportation became such an issue that we passed a law that basically states the governor, in case of emergency, can ask the legislature, 85 members in the House and 29 members in the Senate, to be able to shift those funds to meet his constitutional mandate for education. So they have that option. But everybody wanted this umbrella to go around transportation to make sure it couldn't be shifted. People in the environmental community don't want to see money come out of Program Open Space because that's a dedicated fund. Well, what's your priority? Is it education? Is it land purchase? Or is it transportation? And the Constitution of the state of Maryland says it has to be K-12 education. Now, if he's looking to reduce mandates in education, we don't know what they are. If you can share them with us this morning, we would be enlightened by anything that you could tell us. But we're certainly ready to sit down with the governor and have those discussions.
Thank you, Brian.
Thanks.
First question from the audience.
Good morning. My name is Davon Love, Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle from Baltimore. Just two questions about police reform. First, just the amendments in Law Enforcement Officer Bill of Rights that I think would help best address accountability, one being allowing folks outside of law enforcement to investigate officers alleged to engage in excessive force. Currently, only other sworn law enforcement can do that. So just want to know your position on that. The other amendment about the 10 days. So why is it that law enforcement need 10 days when they're public employees, and if there's a lawyer present, she'd be able to speak directly to a supervisor that can assess whether or not that officer needed to be disciplined. And then just the second part of my question, you know, there are a lot of folks who know that police brutality has been an issue for decades. It's not a new issue. And it's mostly been people of African descent, people of color, who've been the most directly affected by police brutality. And one of the things that I think people wonder is, you know, why did it take a national media spectacle to convene a task force on policing when these issues existed before it hit the public mainstream? You know, what would you say to those, including folks like myself, that will question the sincerity of the convening of a police work group after a major uprising when many of the legislative reforms that folks are pushing, they're going to push during this General Assembly, were introduced in Annapolis last year?
Well, have you seen the 26 proposals that were proposed yesterday? Have you read them yet? You looked at them? We addressed most of your concerns. This is a commission chaired by two legislators from Baltimore City, Senator Catherine Pugh and who's your house?
Delegate
Kurt Anderson.
Kurt Anderson. But they've come from 26 proposals. They didn't adopt all the proposals of the chief of police, all the proposals of the mayor of Baltimore, certainly didn't adopt the wishes of the Baltimore City Police and other law enforcement officers throughout the United States, through the state. But these are very bona fide, really proposals that are going to move us forward in terms of addressing a number of those concerns you addressed in terms of law enforcement Bill of Rights, you know, a citizen on the review board, you know, a longer time for citizens to file complaints, eliminating the notary public, et cetera, et cetera. So we've been looking at this for some time. And it affects our entire state, Somerset County, Garrett County, not just Baltimore City. So it affects, and also we're setting up a standard commission so that the same rules apply across the state, not just in Baltimore City. So hopefully some good will have come from the horrible occurrence that happened in Baltimore City.
And the answer to part of your second part of your question is, look, we meet two or three times a year with Maryland Association of Counties, which includes Baltimore City. And we ask them what their priorities are. And to the best of my knowledge, they've never said, you know, we have a problem with transparency of policing, the law officers' Bill of Rights, or the training programs that they go through. They've never come to us and said, look, we need you to address this as a General Assembly. We're the county government standing behind this. We're the city government standing behind it. They are all local police departments. And they respond to their local elected leaders, whether it's the mayor, whether it's the county executive, whatever it is. And if they're having an issue, they come to us and ask their delegations and the General Assembly to take a lead. In this instance, the national issue, which is unfortunate that took place and the era that were made, it did come to the level of the General Assembly without going through all the counties and the mayor to make sure that we reviewed these policies. And that's the recommendations that come to us from the commission that was established. And there were two very talented people that chaired that from Baltimore City, Senator Pugh and Delegate Anderson.
Also, this is a national issue. Honestly, yeah. It's heightened by issues in Florida, heightened by issues in Missouri, heightened by issues in Chicago. And, it's something that needed to have happened before. It's going to happen now, and we're going to move forward on that issue.
There's more to ask about this, but let me tell you, we have to take a very brief break here. We're here at the 13th Annual Annapolis Summit. At the Governor Coward House, speaking with our President of the Senate, Speaker of the House, here on the Mark Steiner Show on WEA 80.9 FM, the voice of the community, with our partner, The Daily Record. We'll be right back. This is Mark Steiner, and we are here for our 13th Annual Annapolis Summit in Annapolis at the Governor Calvert House, where we talk with the governor, the speaker, the president, and a special event coming up. The end of this program today is a conversation with our retiring Senator Barbara Mikulski, who will be joining us. And we're here to take your questions and thoughts and ideas here at the Annapolis Summit. And it's 13 years, so it's good to have you all here with us in this large audience. Let me follow up before we go back to the audience what was said before we went to break here. Part of what I think Dave Von Love was talking about, who the man who asked the question, and I heard what you were saying, Speaker Bush, about counties having raised this issue before. But in the past, the ACLU in Maryland has raised lawsuits around police, state police conduct, stopping African Americans on the roads of Maryland. More than white people are stopped. Mm-hmm. There's been a question of police brutality, a question of race and racism inside police departments. It's not a new question. I think what's happened is the videotaping of these incidents, whether it's been Baltimore or whether it's in Florida or whether it's been in Ohio, Chicago, wherever it's been, right. New York, have brought it to the light and forced us to deal with it. I mean, so how do we, in that larger sense, having that commission with the senator and the delegate running it, is really critical. All of us are anxious to see how this is going to play out on the floor. But just dealing with that whole issue that we're facing in this state of race and racism and police departments and the question of that's a huge right. underlying issue. So what is your role in dealing with that? I mean, just as not necessarily a bill you may pass, but as our political leaders
Let me just make one comment. We have this commission that has numerous recommendations, and if we pass those recommendations, they still have to be implemented at the local level. So we pass legislation that calls for more transparency, and X county decides they're not going to utilize that tool. I mean, it's not like we know about it unless somebody comes forward from that area. If we call for more training and the counties don't abide by that, I mean, we control the state police force. We do not control Baltimore City Police Department. We do not control the Anne Arundel County Police Department. We set a framework that we hope that all those people follow.
But the law enforcement officers
which also rights, includes, which also includes, you know, psychological evaluations now. It also includes more recruitment of women and African Americans on the police department.
Right.
I mean, for example, I represent Prince George's County. Prince George's County, we have an African American county executive. Supermajority of African American County County Council. You know, we're going to have an African-American chief of police. And, you know, we don't have this issue in Prince George's County. I'm sure it's there in certain areas, but it hasn't come to the forefront in the least bit from any of these elected officials or from the citizens of Prince George's County. And so I don't hear from them.
But there are two things. The state does have, you do have role in terms of law officers, the Bill of Rights. I mean, that's where you can make a change,
right.
A and B.
And we're making
that change.
Right. That's where you have the power to make change. And I guess, I mean, there have been lots of cases, I think, Prince George's police have been notorious, I think, in many ways, in terms of their treatment of African-American citizens. That's not been you're saying that doesn't exist?
The treatment of everybody, it exists. I mean, if you flee from a police officer, in the old days of Prince George's County, so they've got to chase you 90 miles an hour, 100 miles an hour, 5 miles, to take their lives. Guess what? You get hit with a flashlight. That's what happened. You got out of the car, they took a flashlight and whacked you across the head. Nobody objected. You know, times have changed. Now they treat you a little bit more discretion, a little bit easier. But I mean, those things have happened. I'm telling you right now.
I would hope that changed. I mean,
well, it is what it is.
Well, I don't.
You don't want to flee from a police officer in Prince George's County. I can tell you that right now.
Let me go back to the audience. I'll come back in a minute one.
Go ahead, ma'am. Good morning. I have a question for both Senate President Miller and House Speaker Bush. But given that 71% of the chicken farmers with the large chicken industries are at or below the poverty line without off-farm income, and with the recent expose on the John Oliver show, it mentioned that there's the abuse of contract growers that explains their inability to speak out. So do you support legislation like the Farmers Rights Act that provides equity and protection for the growers?
I don't understand that question. Do you understand that question?
Yeah.
Okay, why don't you restate it?
Okay, if I say this right, correct.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, I'm sorry.
They're saying that 30%, is what you said?
71%.
Of farmers live near poverty or at poverty levels.
Right.
And I think the question is, whose responsibility is it to deal with the manure that flows in? Is it the farmers, many of whom are struggling, or is it companies like Purdue and Tyson, other companies who should be paying part of the freight?
Well, this is specifically in the abuse of contracts with the large chicken corporations, their inability to speak out with the abuses without whistleblower protections. So the Farmer Rights Act would give equity and protections to the farmers to speak out against these abuses.
I see. So legal protection for farmers to be able to speak out.
Yes.
Against companies that they have contracts with without fear of retribution.
You got it.
That's what they're talking about.
I'm a Farm Bureau member. I represent three counties. I participate in the Farm Bureaus in three counties. And, I'm not familiar with this issue, honestly and truly. I've been to the Calvert Farm Bureau this year. I'm going to the Charles County Farm Bureau on Saturday, and I'll be at the Prince George County Farm Bureau Monday. But I'll look into this issue. But generally, I come down on the side of the farmers. I have cousins that are the largest producers of produce in Prince George's County. And I go into Giant Food, and I see produced by Miller Farms, Piscataway, Maryland. I'm very proud. They also produce farms for Farming for Hunger. They give back to the poor and things of that nature. They're the best preservationists, the best people that we can have in a facility. They're God-fearing, law-abiding, hard-working people, and we need more farmers. Agriculture continues to be the number one business in the state of Maryland. We need to support our farmers in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, look, I think the specific legislation she's talking about, and obviously we'll go through one of the committees this year, and certainly they'll visit the pros and cons of that. I don't know if it exists anywhere else in the country, whether there's a model legislation out there, but certainly we want to do everything we can to protect our farmers.
One of the things that we didn't get a chance to ask the governor about because the time was so short, and it was my fault for not bringing it up in the beginning, I thought we were going to have it from the audience, which was his announcement that they want to put money into demolition of houses in Baltimore City. And you've made a lot in the last few months, Speaker, Mr. Speaker, about investing in Baltimore and trying to address those issues. One of the things that people, I think, are very nervous about when it comes to this demolition, not that many of the houses do not need to be demolished, and that if you go through Baltimore, sometimes it looks like you feel like you're looking at pictures of Dresden after World War II. I mean, and the young people have to get up every morning and walk past those abandoned houses. Nobody should have to live like that. But the question is, the fear is that, okay, you demolish these houses, But where is the plan about what happens next? Where's the plan about what happens to the people who live in those communities?
The mayor has a very distinct plan that she's put together. She has a young man named Mike Braverman who has outlined where the demolition should take place, who would contract to rebuild those blocks, how much it costs to tear down every building that's vacant, how much it costs to take someone in that block and that's been displaced and find them a home to live in. So it's a very detailed plan that the mayor has laid out called Vacants to Value. And they have a plan of how to move through the city, what blocks to take down. And it's much easier in a block of 10 houses if 9 of them are vacant. It's not like this is like it just came out of the sky. It's a pretty detailed plan. The question is, you need the money to do the demolition. And if you get the money to do the demolition, then you have the developers that are ready to go in and rebuild those communities.
It's already being done in Chicago and Detroit, Cleveland, Philadelphia. So you have roadmaps in terms of how to do this. You run into questions of eminent domain, but the problem that I see it right now is, you know, the governor announcing this and, you know, the two meshing together. Again, it's a matter of communication. The state of Maryland communicating with the local government in terms of how to do this. The way Philadelphia has done this is they've set up a private corporation, private entity to come in and quasi-government institutions, sort of like a Washington Suburban Sanitary Commission or the Maryland National Park and Planning Commission, to come in and make these decisions and move it forward so that there is political oversight, but at the same time, sort of like the Stadium Authority, like the government right. bringing the Stadium Authority in to make this thing happen. Or like we did, we delegated the Stadium Authority to do the billion-dollar investment in Baltimore City schools. But it's going to happen. But it should be planned from A to Z, and all you have to do is look at the roadmaps and what other Rust Belt cities, and not that I'm calling Baltimore Rust Belt City, but where cities where manufacturing was and is now challenged, it's going on all the time. And you learn from your, like I was in an event just a week ago, and you hear these ideas, what's happening in other states. I was the one that brought this justice reinvestment to the state from hearing what other states are doing on it. You learn from other states and you bring it to your state and make positive things happen.
So what is that? That's $700 million. Is that new money?
Well, there's money that's in the budget every year for demolition that people basically line up for across the state of Maryland. A lot of it's gone to Baltimore, but it's gone to different subdivisions across the state. The greatest need right now is in Baltimore City. You have to enhance the amount of money the governor puts into the capital budget to do the demolition, where he has to assign PAYGO money to do that. So it is an existing program. It is not a new program. This is a program that has existed for quite a few years under the O'Malley administration that we've dealt with demolition in the city and other areas of the state of Maryland.
The way it was described just sounded like a much larger program than we've ever seen, that people have ever seen in Baltimore before.
Well, if the money is there, it'll be a much larger program, yes. Well,
I mean,
that's
well,
right.
But how can you be real proud of demolition? I mean, it's a large money mounting for demolition. Again, what we pointed out is what's going to happen after you demolish the building.
Right.
You know, parks, that's, recreation, new housing. People need to see that as well.
Well, that's the question I was raising earlier. Right. I mean, how do we know that the people in those neighborhoods are going to be taken care of?
We haven't been told that.
Good morning. My name is Gary Brennan. I'm a 30-year teacher in Frederick County. In the last decade plus, students and teachers have seen an explosion in required standardized testing that soaks up time and resources and directs too much of what we have to do in the classroom. The governor earlier today said he recognizes overtesting as a problem, but it's not a priority for him this year. And I was wondering if the General Assembly was going to take up anything. For example, President Obama has called for a 2% cap on the amount of time students spend in standardized testing. New York State has taken action to do this in their state. And I was wondering if either of you will support something to give relief now, because these kids, you know, they're whatever year of education they're in, this is their only year for that. And we need relief now. And I wondered if the legislature is going to take that up at all this year.
Well, the question is, the kids need relief or do the teachers need relief? That's a teacher's position also. My mother's a school teacher. My sister's a school teacher. And, you know, they always had 35 students in a classroom. Overcrowded.
41.
Well, you know, you have way too many, for sure. We set up a commission to look at the testing. Senator Pinsky, an educator, created this commission. The government wants to take credit for it. But let's look, see what it comes about. And I think it'll be a balance between the 2% and what's currently happening. And there needs to be relief for the students and for the teachers so that they can best do their job. But finding the right median and the right testing is very important, because guess what? Our students are not doing well. They're not doing well as compared to Canada, as compared to Ireland, even as compared to Vietnam. You know, we in the United States last year created 80,000 engineers, the same number of engineers that Mozambique created. China created 800,000 engineers. We can do better here in Maryland. We can do better in the United States, but we need to make certain that teachers have the tool to do their jobs, which includes testing to make certain that teachers are accountable and that students are understanding and learning what they're doing, but not over-testing.
Yeah, look, we're working with the MSEA plus Senator Pinsky's group on streamlining the test process to the benefit of both the students and the educators. But more importantly, the students. I mean, I have a daughter who's a senior in high school. Between AP tests and all the other standardized tests she has to take, we seem like we're always gearing towards a national test rather than the day-to-day work that should take place in the classroom. So there is a concern there. I think there's a way to streamline this. We'll wait to see some of the data that comes out of the Pinsky Commission and some of the data that we get from Maryland State Teachers Association as well, before we go forward. But I want to thank you for what you do.
Thank you.
To all the teachers. A couple quick questions here before we go back to the audience. And the things that we've heard are coming up. One of those issues is going to be this. We're approaching that time where the redistricting happens and the governor makes a plan. State makes a plan about what the new congressional and House and Senate districts will look like. That's something he's mentioned before to the press, that he wants to have more power in that. Democrats have said that they want to be able to have voters, eligible voters, just be registered to vote, period. They can go in and vote. So is there truth on both sides of this equation here, that we need to have a more equitable way of doing our districts so the formula is kind of more towards where the population is and not just for Democrats in charge making the decision or Republicans if they're in charge making the decision, as well as the idea of everybody should just have the right to vote, period, and be able to be eligible and vote?
I don't think it's a question the governor wants, because the governor has all the power right now. The governor draws the plans and submits them to the General Assembly. It's very difficult for the General Assembly to come up with a consensus plan. Drawing lines, looking statistics, and all of a sudden you're representing people you never represented before. It's a very arduous process, but it's good politics for the governor. No state east of the Mississippi has done this. Not a single state east of the Mississippi has done this, but the governor wants to do this. He wants to say, I can do it. I want this done. No other state east of the Mississippi has done it. It's done by a few states with sagebrush revolutions in the West, but it's good Republican Party politics. It's good speaking points. And, we're happy to move forward. I'm happy to move forward. If, for example, you want to team Maryland with, say, North Carolina or Maryland, Virginia or Maryland, Pennsylvania, et cetera, so that different states are treated equally in a group, so that you have the same opportunity to elect equal number of Republicans and Democrats, we would be happy to do something like that. But just simply taking us as isolation, Maryland does this, whereas North Carolina has 13 congressmen, 9 Republican districts, 3 African American districts, and 1 for the eggheads in North Carolina, Duke, and Wake Forest, and what have you. You know? I'll put you in that category.
Which category is that?
Duke, North Carolina, Wake Forest.
I went to Temple University, we were one city.
Yeah, yeah.
Look, I think that, agree with the President of the Senate here. Look, the governor has all the power to draw the lines here. You need 85, you need a supermajority in both houses to approve congressional redistricting. It's got to be an exact science. You have to come almost exactly make the districts conform to the numbers. There's more flexibility in legislative redistricting. Last year it was petitioned to referendum. The map that the state drew was overwhelmingly supported by the citizens of the state. This is something that I think is a national issue. If if there's a way to do this constructively without political bias, and I don't know how you do that.
The problem is there are no federal guidelines. Right. That's the problem. Our state, we have guidelines in our Constitution. Compact, contiguous, same number of numbers. You take into effect the county lines. You can take into effect municipal boundaries, et cetera. There are none, and never have been for the federal government. So the governor and legislatures of each individual state are able to so-called gerrymander, draw the lines that they want to, and California, Texas, what have you. There's a little judicial oversight, but it's been minimal to this point.
Right.
And the other part of the question you put in there was expansion of voting rights, and I believe that should be a universal expansion for people to have the franchise to vote. I think it's very important. This country has had a history of putting hurdles and impediments in front of people, mainly minorities, to go to the polls and vote. It's something I've witnessed even when I was in the General Assembly here for years of different ways that people would think of to keep people from the polls. And I think the more people that have access to the polls, whether they go or not, is what America and Maryland should be all about.
Back to the audience.
Good morning. So in 2014, the renewable energy credits retired under the Maryland Renewable Portfolio Standard came primarily from burning forms of waste, such as trash incinerators. So would you support efforts to clean up the RPS so that our renewable energy can be truly clean, coming primarily from solar and wind?
Look, I think that there's legislation pending to increase the renewable portfolio to a higher percentage. That'd be pending in economic matters and finance this year. And I think taking the consideration of waste into effect is something they will also be talking about. So, you know, we'll watch that process go through the Economic Matters Committee and the Finance Committee. But I think they've been pretty responsive to increasing the renewable portfolio and trying to keep clean energy and make clean energy and solar energy and wind energy a priority in that renewable portfolio.
It's a very complicated issue involving landfills as well. You know, I sort of defer to the committees on this, and I'm happy to listen to your concerns and hear the testimony from the committees and make a final decision on it. Thank you.
Another question from the audience before we close out and have a final question here.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And I want to ask this question of both of you, actually. And I'm Father Ty Hollinger. I'm pastor of three parishes in Baltimore City and with Interfaith Worker Justice of Maryland. Right. And a question, an issue that's been impacting Maryland working families for many years now, given the realities that over 40% of Marylanders are unable to earn paid sick days, will you support legislation this year that will allow workers to earn up to 7 paid sick days while requiring businesses, small businesses, with fewer than 10 employees to provide their workers with job-protected, unpaid sick days? And if you support this, will you work in your leadership positions to bring this to the floor of the entire assembly this year for
vote? Well, that sounds like a compromise that I haven't heard of before, honestly. It's this is an issue that's come to the forefront of the General Assembly for the past couple of years. And last session, the committee members charge the proponents, the opponents, to get together and come up with a solution. At this meeting I was at this past week, I met with a representative from McDonald's Corporation for the whole United States. And they're going to make a major announcement within 3 weeks in terms of changing their sick leave policy, to expand their sick leave policy. So I think gradually small businesses as well as large businesses understand that the importance that this is about quality of life as well as economic development. I think we'll be able to move forward at some point in time. I know right now our focus this year in the Senate is pay equity for women. We're going to make certain that passes as well. And while we're going to look at this and see if we can come up with a compromise involving small business as well as large business, because one size does not fit all.
I can't add anything to that. That's basically the same position that the House has.
All right. There was one thing that came up, and it was at least the papers have been talking about it, and some people have raised it to me, which is the right to have a physician help end of life, right to die. That's going to come up. What are your positions on that?
I personally believe that that legislation will eventually get here. I do support it with all the, if it has all the safeguards in it. I think they had a very good conference in the interim commission in the interim that fine-tuned that quite a bit. I think you'll see that as an issue that grows in support, whether it takes place this year or in the future. It is optional. No one has to do it. I've watched too many friends that would love to have that option towards the end of life. And so I do support that initiative with all the safeguards that you would need into it. We look at Oregon right now and a couple other states that have it. But I think that will take a little bit of time before it comes to the forefront.
As the speaker says, I think it's going to take some time. I don't gerrymander or alter my committees, depending upon the issue. But that issue has always gone to the Judicial Proceedings Committee. And Senator Zirkin's chairman of the committee from Baltimore County. And for whatever reason, that bill did not come out of the committee last year. And I will look at the bill again this year, see what their thinking is. But it's a lot of emotion on both sides of the issue. I personally would like that for myself, but we'll see.
But that's an issue that you're not going to push other legislators on either. They're going to come to that conclusion by themselves.
And I do want to thank both of you again this year for being part of the 13th Annapolis Summit. Our Senate President Mike Miller, House Speaker Michael Bush.
Thank
always
you, Mark.
Good to see you both.
3M production.
It's great to have you both. Good to have you both here. And I hope that we've learned many new things, I think, today from the President about flashlights.
And the men in blue are there for you.
And eggheads. We're going to take a very brief break. When we come back, we'll be joined by Senator Barbara Mikulski. Don't go away.